ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Yes, the power of smell is one of our most fundamental senses, isn't it? It can conjure up emotions, it can linger in the air, it can be used as a means of seduction. Maybe you associate a certain scent with someone you know. I certainly do. Having walked past someone at the shops and immediately recognised their perfume, maybe because it was the same one your mum or your grandma wore, or a long-lost love once wore, and back come flooding the memories. As the famous French fashion designer Gabrielle Chanel once said, perfume is the unseen, unforgettable, ultimate accessory. During the 1970s, the winds of change were palpable. Global society and politics were undergoing a lot of transformations, and the billion-dollar fragrance market was also experiencing its own revolution. It cemented perfume as the ultimate accessory, not just to be used occasionally, but as a daily staple. French perfume makers, which had reigned the fragrance industry for centuries, were being challenged by upstarts in the new worlds springing up in the United States. And what resulted was a flurry of creativity that ushered in a new era for fragrances. Tonight, I'm welcoming back to Nightlife the perfume guru, Michael Edwards, who's going to tell you all about the fascinating evolution of modern-day fragrances. Michael began working in the fragrance industry in the 1960s, and for the past 40 years, he's produced the annual Fragrances of the World Compendium, a Bible of perfume classification. He's also the author of Perfume Legends, which tells how some of France's most iconic fragrances were developed. Opium, Chanel No. 5, and so on. His latest book is called American Legends, which talks about the evolution of American fragrances. Now, Michael can answer, I bet, almost any question you ask about perfume. So give him a call, 1-300-800-222. I'd be very surprised if he can't. 1-300-800-222. He's getting embarrassed here. He's in the studio with me. Michael, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. It's good to be back.
Can I get you a bit closer to that microphone?
Good evening, Philip. It's good to be talking with you again.
Well, it's great to have you in as well. Well, when we think of modern perfumes, almost everyone automatically thinks, oh, well, perfume, that means French perfume. But that's not actually the case, isn't it? Well,
no,
France eventually did build a legacy, on their craftsmanship of raw materials and couture integration. But the foundation for modern commercial perfumes was laid down in England during the 16th and 17th century.
In fact, even before then, it was first laid down in Cologne, Germany, in 1709, when Jean-Marie Farina created the first eau de cologne. If you wonder why it didn't happen before, it was very simple. For thousands of years, perfume was oil perfumes. Mm. And because the reality is that you couldn't get clean-smelling alcohol to dissolve the perfume oils in. You just couldn't eliminate the smell of old wine, for example.
Mm.
It wasn't until the end of the 1600s that the perfumers started to be able to refine alcohol to a point that it didn't have a smell. And that's logically why, in the 1700s, we got the first eau de colognes. I wish I could tell you they were the first perfumes. They weren't, in the sense that they were not designed to be perfumes. Men and women at that time were afraid of bathing. There was the feeling that water could open the pores of your skin and allow miasmas of diseases to go into you. Queen Elizabeth of England, for example, was regarded as eccentric for taking 2 to 3 baths a year.
Whether she needed them or not.
But, Philip, can you imagine the stench? Can you imagine how uncomfortable one felt? Imagine then if suddenly a product created that you could splash onto a cloth, wipe over your body. Imagine the feeling of refreshment. Suddenly you feel clean. And that was why Jean-Marie Farina made such a success.
Because when we're talking about the origins of the perfume industry, we're talking about people who create fragrances, aren't we? As opposed to things that smelt nice, which people put on themselves.
Yes.
Which probably dates back to, whenever. I mean, the Egyptians would have had these. I mean, the
certainly oils. But remember, to try to get oils, you probably use the heavy oils, the musks, the amber notes. Mm. The idea of light, fresh citrus notes or floral notes, you couldn't do it with the oils. Nothing happened.
Mm.
You mentioned the English. In fact, it was in the 1700s that London became the centre of perfumery. Think, for example, of Florus, 1730, or Yardley, 1770, or Atkinson, 1799. But
does Yardley date back to the 18th century? Wow.
Well, oh, yes, as far as that.
Mm.
And I know that people think that the French invented perfume. It's not quite true.
Mm.
And people tend to think that real perfume is French perfume. But did you know that the first blockbuster perfume was not English, it was not German, it was not French, it was American. It was in 1872 that Colgate introduced a perfume called Cashmere Bouquet.
What?
I'm serious.
What? No.
Yep. And it was so successful.
Now, I know there was no Chanel in the 19th century, but hang on. The French were short. What? You're saying the toothpaste company was the...
This was long before then. And believe it or not, it became so successful that it propelled Colgate into the perfume business. When the company turned 100 in 1906, their catalogue had no less than 625 different perfumes.
Colgate.
I bet you never knew that kind
of one. I did not. But hang on. Let's stay with him for a second. So... When did they get out of perfume and get into toothpaste?
When you discovered that you wouldn't mind feeling fresh, and they made more money.
You made more money out of
toothpaste. Remember that there was competition. In the second half of the 1800s, there was a frenzied search by the chemists for all the ingredients. I mean, when you think of perfume oils, it's as though nature has created chemical storehouses.
Mm.
You try to pull apart the scent of jasmine and you'll discover over 800 compounds. Many of them have got a smell. Mm. Nature put them together to create that signature scent of jasmine. Mm. And so the chemists became fascinated with the synthetic possibility.
How do you construct these things?
That's right. Yeah. And that was the focus in France. And for the second half of the 19th century, Paris became the center of fashion and perfumery again there. But there were four perfumers that changed the world. In 1874, Paul Parquet created a perfume, Fougère Royale.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first fragrance that incorporated a synthetic note, coumarin, which had been extracted from tonka beans. Then came Aimé Guerlain, 1889, the Eiffel Tower year.
Mm.
He created Jicky, regarded as probably the first perfume that was an art. Before then, the perfumers were trying to imitate nature, the scent of violet, the scent of rose. Jicky was an abstract construction. And today we regard it as the start of modern perfumery. But then...
Yeah, go on.
No, carry on.
No, I was going to say, because there are certain base notes in perfume, aren't there? There are florals.
Those were created by François Coty, who followed Aimé Guerlain.
Okay, so I'm jumping ahead of you. So you continue. Yeah.
It was he, the genius, who created the first floral oriental, L'Origan, in 1908. It was he who created the first chypre or mossy woody note in 1917 with Chypre de Coty. And it was he who created the modern oriental with Emerald in 2021. But what Coty pioneered, Jacques Guerlain perfected. His Le Bleu of 1912 developed what Coty had started in L'Origan. Guerlain's Mitsuku of 1919 was an evolution of Chypre de Coty.
Mm-hmm.
And his Chalimard of 1925 was the evolution of Emerald there. First World War changed things.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1920s, that was the decade of designers. Chanel, Worth, Jean Patou.
Mm.
In terms of perfume, we were talking number five at Arpège.
So was Chanel number five? Because there were a number of numbers that Chanel produced, weren't
there? Yes, there were.
But number five was their most famous. What do you? How do you describe that? That's a floral? Is it a floral perfume?
It's actually what we call an aldehydic fragrance. Soft floral is the way I would describe it. Mm-hmm. It's florals mixed with a synthetic note, aldehydes, which come from rose oil or citrus oil. Mm. They don't smell very nice, actually, but they have this amazing ability to enhance the scent of other oils. Mm-hmm. And they create such a sparkling effect that you have to soften it, usually with musks or powdery notes or iris. And that creates that soft, powdery note that became the signature of number five.
Because it's such a distinctive smell, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
1-300-800-222 is my number. Michael Edwards is with us. He's a fragrance historian. If you've got questions, lines are free. 1-300-800-222. Karen's with us. Karen, where are you? I'll dig you out of my perfume cupboard here. Hi, Karen.
Mm-hmm. Hi there. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for taking my call. I just have a question about pheromones and, like, with scent and everything. I know it's probably not like perfume exactly, but it is, you know, like humans put off a smell.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm right or I'm wrong, please correct me. Mm. And the reason I say this, and it's nothing to do with perfume, it's like I think male and female scents are so different. And I can remember when my husband and I used to do a lot of fishing, I would always catch more fish than him. And I would say to him, it's to do with the pheromones, because I'd put the same bait on my hook that he would put on.
Yeah.
I would always catch more fish. Is there any truth in that? I just out of curiosity, and nothing to do with perfume, but it's a human scent.
Yeah, that's a point, Michael. To what extent? Because I've often heard that some people can wear some perfumes and others can't, because perfume interacts with a person's skin and therefore a person's natural fragrance themselves. Is that a thing?
Absolutely. Yes.
So
who was it who once said that everybody's created equal until they wear perfume?
Okay, so some people, so if I put Chanel number 5 on some people, it'll smell different?
Certainly.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. It's because of the oils it reacts in, with the natural
yeah. oils in the person's skin.
Certainly.
Yeah. Well, 1-300-800-222. Julie from Mount Garnet says, Phil, remember Cashmere Bouquet? Was that a Colgate soap, was it?
Was originally Colgate soap and perfume.
Cashmere Bouquet,
the one we've just been talking about.
I'm still interested in the Colgate story. So this is an American perfume, and it becomes the biggest selling perfume in the world.
At that time.
Yeah. Okay. And it was, well, how would you describe it as a perfume?
It was an ambery floral.
Right. Okay.
Very potent.
Yeah. So what caused its demise, or is it just that Colgate decided to get out of the perfume business? Or?
I think, you know, after the Second World War, when the perfume and the designers came in, that was not part of Colgate's world. They probably persevered with the soap through into the 30s and the 40s. Mm. But by the time the 50s came, the market had changed. Mm. And Colgate as a company had changed. Remember, by that stage, they were about 130 years old.
Mm.
And the toiletry business had become a big one, and fragrance was minor at that stage. They didn't keep up.
The cultural shift of women returning to the workforce out of the Second World War in the 40s and 50s really changed things a lot, didn't it?
It totally.
Tell me about that.
Well, the 1970s produced two blockbusters.
Mm.
One was Charlie by Revlon. Mm. The other was Opium. One French, one American. Charlie was the most pivotal change at that time because it was the first perfume that spoke to women who were working.
Mm.
The reality is that until then, most women did not ever buy a perfume for themselves. They expected to be given
because it was given to them by men.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But Revson had realised that when women started to work and moved from home, this was a whole different story.
Mm.
And he was the one who came up with the idea that said, don't wait to be given, buy it for yourself.
Mm.
And by the end of the 70s, women were accounting for more perfume buying for themselves. The men were accounted in giving it to them.
Mm.
The second one which transformed our industry was opium of 1977. It was.
See, I'm old enough to remember the launch of that.
Oh, it's incredible. But it was the perfect synergy of everything. It was the name, the story, the smell,
was
the
it a
pricing.
But was it a new scent?
It really wasn't. It was, in fact, a takeoff of Youth Dew by Estee Lauder.
Oh, okay.
But so beautifully handled.
Hmm.
That it swept
the world. How would you describe it? Is it it's not a floral perfume, is it? Or
it's a soft oriental. It's okay. Incensey oriental with flowers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why was it so? I mean, I often when I looked at it at the time, I thought it's a triumph of marketing, is it? But you're saying that it actually, as a scent, it had something very particular.
Absolutely.
Mm.
You know, marketing can only go so far.
Mm.
When you're talking about scent. If people don't like the smell, no matter how good the marketing, it's not going to work. That's one of the glories about perfume.
Mm.
But this was just the most perfect scent for its time with the impact. It was pure genius and accidental.
Mm.
Yes, it was the first perfect marketing example in perfume, the first great blockbuster.
Yeah.
But the reality was it was an iconic perfume on its own.
Mm. Okay, Jill from Perth. Hi, Jill.
Hello, Phil.
Hello.
I was just going to ask, my husband is pretty much allergic to scents and fragrances, unless they're very expensive ones. And
that's good for you. Good for you, Jill.
Well, yeah, I don't wear them because I don't have a sense of smell, but he can actually, you know, for days feel quite ill if he's been in a social setting where there's, you know, a lot of women wearing different fragrances. He has a theory that years and years ago they didn't have the synthetic side of things in, you know, making them, and that they were made from actual flowers or petals or proper, you know, proper oil. And he wasn't allergic to that. So, you know, the dearer fragrances would have the proper, you know, stuff in them for in the manufacture of them.
Okay.
So is that a thing?
That's an interesting question, isn't it, Michael? This idea, and a lot of people are very bound to this, aren't they? This idea of a natural perfume being, you know, the essence of a flower or the essence of jasmine or the essence of the rose, etc. You think this is a misunderstanding of perfumes, do you?
I'm afraid it is. The reality is that most of the problems that cause allergies come from natural ingredients. The synthetic notes are mainly so tested to such extreme that it eliminates them. But going back to the basics, a great perfume is a blend of the finest natural oils and innovative synthetics. Think of the synthetics as being a skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
And think of the body as being the natural oils. Put them together and you can get an iconic fragrance. I can quite understand that your husband is not nearly as indisposed to the more expensive perfumes. They tend to use finer oils, and therefore there's likely to be less allergy in anywhere. You know, he has one life. Enjoy it while he can.
I'll tell him that.
Tell him that, Jill. That's right.
I will. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for the call. 1-300-800-222. Sue sent us a picture saying you can still buy cashmere bouquet soap and talcum powder. talcum powder. Now, where are we here? We had another. Meg says, for Michael, do you have any information on an oldie called Faulding's Lavender and Musk?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I have a database of some 80,000 fragrances in all, of which 62,000 are public.
Mm.
But no, I've never come across that one.
Okay.
Is it an Australian fragrance?
Apparently so, yes.
Sounds like a chemist
But it sounds, because Faldings was a chemist, yes, was a chain, yes, of chemist shops. So yes, what it could have been, something that was a house product.
Lavender and musk, it sounds like probably the 1960s. Remember Jovan Musk,
mm-hmm,
when the world turned onto musk in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point in America, no less than a quarter of all American perfumes were musk. So I guess that probably came on.
What is musk anyway? Is it actually scraped off the animals?
No. They used to do it, but you had to kill the animals to do that.
Mm.
No, that's not use. The idea, musk itself, is it a mating signal?
Mm.
I've heard discussions. Some people agree, some people disagree. All we know is that with the musk deer, just near the anus, a gland develops which releases this musk scent there. Mm. It's always been regarded as very sexual, but nobody's ever documented that.
Mm.
But then the idea of synthetic musk came about among the hippies. In America, they discovered a synthetic musk oil, which really ponged.
Mm.
And they found that when they put it on themselves, it made them feel clean and they smelt clean. But at the same time, it meant that it disguised the smell of marijuana.
Ah.
And so that became the scent of the hippies of the 1950s and early 60s, and then exploded.
Oh, that's interesting.
Today we have synthetic variations, which are very delightful.
Kate from Canberra. Hello, Kate.
Hi. I've been in the mood of crepe de chine across a few lifetimes, and I wonder whether you had any advice about whether, if I did recklessly purchase a bottle of unopened crepe de chine from back then, 1925, whether it might still have any pong.
Do I understand? Do you have a bottle of crepe de chine?
Do you have a bottle from the 1920s, Kate?
No, but they are advertised as unopened, and it was started in 25.
Okay. Do they last, Michael? I suppose the question is, do they last?
Yes, they can last. I remember, for example, I once smelt at Guerlain a fragrance of Mitsuku, which was in a baccarat bottle, and that had been last produced some 30 years before we smelt it. The bottle had never been opened, and it was absolutely beautiful, but it had been stored in cool conditions. I mean, for those of you who have perfumes and you change them come the summer, for example, what do you do with the perfumes you wear in winter? My suggestion would be cap it, turn the bottle upside down, and store it in your vegetable crisper of the refrigerator.
Okay.
That way it'll keep the temperature. But perfume has to be stored properly, and you really do have to seal that bottle.
Mm.
If it's opened, the chances are it would have deteriorated.
Mm. So you should keep it in the fridge, you're saying?
In the vegetable crisper of the fridge.
Really?
Yes.
Because everyone, I think, or most women would probably keep, men would certainly keep their fragrances in the bathroom cabinet. You're saying that's not the best place for them.
What's the temperature in a bathroom? It goes that's up and down with the heat in the shower.
Steamy and hot. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Thanks, Kate. So, yes, the answer is probably, if you could find such a thing, it's still got some go in it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate. Provided it was properly stored. There are two perfumes that are impossible to now buy, says my texter. One was Crepe de Chine, we just talked about it, and the other was Guerlain's Mitsuki.
No, Mitsuku is here.
It's here, still here?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And despite all the problems with oak moss,
yeah,
the perfumers have been able to really remind us of the original scent from 1919. It's very good.
Okay. 1-300-800-222, lines free. Rhonda from Katoomba. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, good evening. I was just wondering, would it be possible to create an Indigenous Australian scent, but quite preferably with the First Nations citizens, our First Nations citizens, retaining their intellectual property?
Gum leaf, special gum leaf perfume?
Yeah,
from there,
or Bush Tucker.
Hang on. Oh, there must be some brown Baronia perfume out there, yeah, Rhonda, surely.
There would be. Yeah, there would be. Oh, yeah. But I, I'm haven't seen any. And
Michael?
I'm just wondering why it hasn't taken off.
Michael?
Absolutely no reason why that could not be created.
Hmm. It's just an oil, so it could be. Well, I mean, the fragrance of brown Boronia is, as you would be aware, like magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that in the creation of perfumes, that fragrances like that go into a floral suite, which then get mixed with other things. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying it. It depends what the inspiration is.
Okay.
If I were creating, for example, a fragrance such as that, if I were briefing it, I would say, well, first of all, let's understand what natural materials, what natural oils can we get from indigenous plants and flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've got that, then you've got the palette, then you can start creating. You don't necessarily have to add their flowers, for example. Indigenous Australian flowers can be used. Boronia would be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no reason can't be created.
Mm. Someone said it's a bottle of Faldings, a photograph of a bottle of Faldings lavender water and musk.
Yes.
But it's actually, now look at the bottle, it's actually lavender water.
Okay.
So tell us about that. I mean, lavender, because lavender was a hugely, was a valuable crop for a long time and it was grown widely in Europe in particular, I think, until other markets emerged.
It still is.
And still is, yeah.
And, I mean, you get the English lavender, and the best example of that is Yardley's lavender, still superb.
Right.
You then get the French lavender. Tasmania is renowned for the lavender that it produces. Lavender is still a very important crop.
Okay. Phil, please ask what's happened to tweed, which is now unavailable, says Fiona in Freshwater Creek. What was tweed?
Oh, tweed was a masterpiece that was created after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
But its formula was very complex, and it used oils that they can no longer find. They're price affordable, and people weren't willing to pay for the new oils.
When you say you can no longer find, really, tell me about that. I mean, what would they be?
Well, for example, oak moss. Oak moss was used in perfumes like Mitsuku.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very heavy kind of oil.
Where's it obtained from?
Well, from Cyprus was one of the original parts of the world.
Right.
It comes from oak trees. Yeah, okay. The little moss that grows on them there.
Oh, it comes from a moss that grows on an oak tree.
But
okay. The
problem is that many people are allergic to it, which is why it's no longer permitted to be used in perfumes.
Okay.
We substitute a patchouli for oak moss in most of those classic fragrances.
Okay. All right, 1-300-800-222. Jack in Sydney says, Faldings, an amazing company. I think it's from South Australia. They manufacture the best supplements and vitamins, and their quality runs rings around substances that are way more popular and way more expensive. Yeah, no, that's right. They're a chemist chain, Faldings, I'm sure. Elizabeth is on the line from Melbourne. G'day, Elizabeth.
Hello there. Hello. This has been lovely listening to this. I've just been out and got my 2 bottles of perfume here, but one's only a little wee one. I think I started wearing opium when it came out. I'm 87 now, and I can't afford it now. It's so expensive, but I found a very similar one, and it's Obsession for Men.
Oh,
you're absolutely right.
How many people comment on it, how nice it is.
You're absolutely right. Obsession for Men is a masculine interpretation of the original opium. And for you, it'll work better, in fact. I think the original opium would be a little too heavy for you now. But the obsession has got a lightness to it, which probably appeals.
I love it. Thank you for that. I'm glad I rang.
Pleasure.
Elizabeth. Bye-bye. So should you find, Michael, should you find a perfume that suits or people that suits yourself or suits other people who smell it when you're wearing it and stick with it? Is that the best way to proceed?
My personal feeling is yes. As you get older, the perfumes that you love become your memories. Keep wearing them. That's why when I'm asked what perfume would I recommend to an older woman, I'd say find out what perfume she loves to wear and give her then the body products, the bath oil, the dusting powder, the hand lotion or body lotion, because those are the products that she'd never buy for herself.
Mm. the perfume itself, as we know, the oil, the essence of it is always more expensive than the
price. It's the concentration.
And that's to do with the concentration.
Essentially, yes. You've got the strengths of the eau de cologne, then the eau de parfum, eau de cologne, eau de toilette, eau de parfum, esprit de parfum, and then the parfum in that order.
Okay. All right. Deb from Hobart. Hi, Deb.
Hi, this is just a delicious conversation. And I would like believe it or not, my 12-year-old grandson is absolutely smitten with the concept of fragrance, and we go in and out of department stores sniffing everything, and he is absolutely convinced that oud is the basis of all fragrance. He's not with me at the moment, obviously, but I'd love to pass all this information on to him. And is there a perfume or a fragrance that you would recommend for a teenager?
Well, what you have is part of the new phenomena. We've discovered that since COVID, boys have fallen in love with perfume.
Yeah.
They now come into department stores, perfumeries, they try, they're willing to buy. Somehow they manage to convince their fathers to spend 200, 300, 400, even 500 euros. If you wanted to know the perfumes, I'd ask him, first of all, Creed, Aventus, A-V-E-N-T-U-S. Has he ever smelt that or bought it? I say it because it was a fragrance that totally transformed Creed, the little old English perfume company. And finally, 3 years ago, Creed as a brand was sold to another company for, believe it or not, $3.75 billion.
Nice.
Gives you an idea of the impact. Another one would be Dior's Sauvage. So it's the French version of that. It came out about 10 years ago. It's today the world's largest selling fragrance, both men and women, a remarkable scent. And Dior's first real success. They have tried so hard for 50 years to create a successful fragrance. The first one that they achieved was J'adore. Of 1999, and then came Sauvage. So I'd recommend Sauvage.
This is Eau Sauvage or Eau Sauvage?
No. Eau Sauvage was 1966, the original Dior.
Okay.
But they took the name and they just called it Sauvage, and they had Johnny Depp advertising it.
Oh.
that was the one that promoted.
That might be a reason not to buy it.
And then if you've got a lot of money and you want to make sure that all his Christmases come together. Can I recommend that you go to Maison François Kurkdjian and smell Baccarat Rouge 540?
Okay. This is going to be a very expensive journey.
Have you got this down, Deb? Because
I'll be able to play it back to him.
Yeah.
Good for you.
We'll have this conversation up as a podcast a little later. Anyway, get ready for a big hit on the plastic at the department store, Deb.
Would you also suggest that he goes to a site called Wiki Parfum, WikiParfum.com. It's totally impartial. It doesn't sell any products, but we provide all the content for that, and he'll be able to see other fragrances that I think will interest him.
Okay. Men have always worn perfumes, haven't they, Michael, or not? Or did it become a thing after the war?
Look, during late 1700s...
I don't imagine Winston Churchill wore perfume, did he? No,
you probably not.
No.
Look, during the 1700s and the early 1800s, yes, fragrance was something for men. In fact, more men than women wore it.
Yeah.
But from then on, to wear fragrance was really not masculine, because the British never thought that a man should wear perfume. And it wasn't until the 1960s that suddenly a brand came out, Brut by Fabergé.
Ah, of course.
Philip, they came out with a line that transformed the whole world. Remember before then, to wear perfume was effeminate, sissy. Yeah. And Brut came out with a line that said, if you have any doubts about yourself, wear something else. Suddenly perfume for men became a statement of confidence, and the whole market changed.
I'm trying to think of old ones. The fragrance is Old Spice, for example.
1934.
Now, that's been around forever. Is it still around?
It's still around, and it's still as good.
What's the background story of the perfume 4711? Okay. Says my texter Tracy. I remember my grandmother had this perfume in the 1970s.
Well, I mentioned to you at the start that in 1709, Jean-Marie Farina was launched as the first eau de cologne.
Mm.
Back then, as now, copyright laws were pretty flexible, and it was such an impact at that time that everybody that could tried to create an eau de cologne of their own.
Mm.
And most of them used the name Farina. I once spent a couple of weeks with Jean-Marie Farina in their archives. They're the world's oldest perfume archives, dating back to the 1500s. And there were literally almost 1,000 copies using the name Farina. One of them was the original 4711. It came out in 1792, and they called themselves Farina, because let's face it, you're trying to capitalize on a name that had become famous. Well, the Farina family became so upset that they sued them, and after some 60 years, they won, Mullins, the company that made 4711, was forced to change the name to 4711. It was the best thing that ever happened, and they became the world's leading eau de cologne.
Mm.
But that's the history of 4711.
Mm. Interesting. Pam from Alexandra, I think, and Susanna from Whittlesea have pretty much got the same question too. It's a question about Chanel.
Mourning the disappearance of Chanel 19. Has it gone forever? Because it's my total memory perfume, and I cannot buy it anymore.
What's happened?
No, not at all. No. It's still a major perfume.
Oh, well, it's very hard to buy.
Well, let me suggest you go onto Sephora online, see if you've got that. Mm-hmm. Look at the Chanel site. It would be one of those.
They're still selling it.
That would be wonderful. That's good news. Yes. Thank you. That's my memory perfume.
Yeah. Certainly.
No worries, Pam. It's still around. Yes. Grab it. I think, Susanna, you wanted to ask a similar question, did you?
Well, the thing about number 19 is you cannot get the pure perfume. You can get the eau de toilette. You can get all that stuff, but you can't get the pure perfume.
Well, the reason for that is that Henri Robert, who created it, never believed that particular blend of notes was suited to a parfum strength.
Okay, so we never made it.
No.
There never was. No. So they never.
No, they made it. I have had it.
But it doesn't work.
I'm one of those old ladies that wants my original perfume. And I have had it for a good deal of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say in the last 10 years, it has disappeared. And the thing is that I find that the eau de toilette and the other less concentrated versions of it just disappear on me.
I know.
They don't last.
Mm.
I sympathize with you, but I think that parfum strength of the number 19 has always been such a minor seller. And I know that I was once told by Henri Robert's nephew, Guy Robert, who was my perfume mentor, the reason was he believed that number 19 was a sparkling light fragrance because it was a green note there.
Mm.
That's all I know at the moment. But yes, I understand that it's probably been discontinued.
Mm. Okay. Thank you, Susanna. Andy says, my wife loved Red Door. We're talking about, Michael's new book. My guest is Michael Edwards. He's a perfumer. Expert historian and taxonomist, his new book called American Legends is all about American perfumes, of which Red Door is one.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a major fragrance.
Yeah. Jan from the Central Coast. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I'm just ringing up about a bit of history.
Hmm.
My uncle, great-uncle, actually put the first generic soap and toothpaste into Coles.
And
later on, he went on to have the 3-3 pickles. which the brand is still around.
Okay. Oh, good. So, well, thank you, Jan. That's a, that is a nice, that is a nice piece of history. It's
that's
not,
interesting. It's not, thank you, Jan.
Thank you, Jan. Probably not in our perfume area, but there you go. Nerida from Maria. Hello, Nerida.
Good evening. I'm trying to find out about Balenciaga perfume. Paris, I can't find it. I did, luckily enough, have about 10 years ago, but it was very weak, not like it used to be. So is it still around? Is the company still working?
Balenciaga is. What was the perfume? I didn't catch the name.
Paris.
Paris?
Yes.
Okay, my... I would... question that, I'm afraid, because Paris by agreement had never been used as a perfume name. The original, the only man who'd used it was Francois Coty originally, but since then nobody used it until 1990 when Yves Saint Laurent created a fragrance called Paris. And I have a feeling that that's the fragrance you're thinking of. Paris by Yves Saint Laurent. It's a marvellous rose scent.
Oh, it's a bit more spicy, I would have thought, than rose, but I loved it. And it's sort of, you know, you have perfume and it's just perfect for your body.
Then you I think that would be Paris by Saint Laurent.
All right, then.
Do smell it. Go into a store with Saint Laurent department store and smell it and see if it brings back memories to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Nerida. Thanks, Nerida. 1-300-800-222. Robin says, is White Diamond still around?
Absolutely.
Yes, it is.
That was the fragrance that cemented Elizabeth Taylor's legacy.
Yes, yes.
You know, she made more money from her perfumes than she made from all the movies put together.
These days when, you know, how every film star has a perfume, every celebrity seems to have a perfume, they're... Are they expensive to produce?
Well, yes, because the cost of the oil is the least expensive thing. You have to spread the awareness.
Yeah. Oh. And the marketing and
exactly.
And distribution of the thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So perhaps we ought to have a Philip one.
I wonder what it would be.
Ah.
I wonder what the notes would be. Harry in Melbourne. Hello, Harry.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Not bad.
Yeah, that's good. I just wanted to ask your guest about oud and why it's so hard to get like an original oud and why it's so expensive.
Well, I also asked the same question because I've seen ouds ranging from cheapy to the more expensive price I could never even imagine. The first thing is it takes time. For the trees to mature. It takes time, I understand, for the oud to come out and mature. It's not an easy thing to grow, not an easy thing to develop. I believe, like some ingredients, the sheer scarcity puts the price up, and that is the reason why good oud is so expensive. Is some of it fake? Without a doubt. But the real oud, and I've only smelt it, I think, three times, real great stuff, is quite extraordinary.
Have you smelt it, Harry?
I have, but not the real one. It must be the fake one because it's very, very strong smell.
Yeah.
And if you put a drop of it on your hand, the ones that I've had, it's very expensive. It lasts for days.
But yeah, that's
like watered down. Apparently, like there's even stronger ones.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Harry. Is there a substitute for eau de patou? Says my texter.
Oh, please, eau de patou. I would say try Chanel 19 would be one example of the freshness. Cristal by Chanel, another one to look at.
Okay. Tell us about Calvin Klein because the time, it's disappeared on us. Tell us briefly about Calvin Klein because they exploded the perfume market too, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
First great success was, of course, Obsession.
Yeah.
It was also the start of the money trade. I mean, they backed Obsession with over $20 million at the time, just for the launch.
Mm.
And then Poisson from Dior came along and spent $40 million, and suddenly the whole market went up. Obsession was their first one, and it was remarkably successful, both for the sexual way it looked,
yeah,
the advertising and stuff. Then came Escape, which wasn't as successful. It was a green fragrance. But then came Eternity. And that really was fantastically successful. In the meanwhile, they'd come out with Obsession for Men, Eternity for Men, and then transformed the market in 1994 with CK1, the first shared fragrance.
For men and women.
Yes.
Yeah. 1-300-800-222. What has been... We have to wind up, unfortunately, Michael, but what's been the most... Is there a most successful perfume ever, do you think?
What would nominate Chanel number 5?
Probably number 5, isn't
number
it?
Number 5 would
or
have
opium,
to be.
Or
Opium? Not really, because they've changed Opium, and okay, so it's not the original fragrance there.
Mm. Is Margriff by Carven still available?
Yes, it is.
It is?
Yes.
Is Arpège still available?
Yes, it is, but the formula's changed.
Ah, okay. Frida says, my memory scent is Lagerfeld by Elizabeth Arden. My husband wore it.
Yes. Still very good.
Still
original formula.
And is there a substitute for the discontinued Coriandre by Jean Couturier?
Coriandre by Jean
Couturier.
Mm. It's got such a dry note that... Try Cabochard.
Okay.
That's more leathery.
Okay.
But it has that signature note to it.
Mm. All right, Michael, we're going to have to go.
It's been a pleasure.
But it has been an absolute pleasure too. And it's a completely fascinating topic. And you have an encyclopedic knowledge of it as well. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio again. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Michael Edwards has been my guest.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.